Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, November 2nd, 2018. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. It's Casual Friday, folks. Nothing casual about this week. I may be wearing a soft-collared shirt, but you got to get out there and get your friends, and maybe even just this week, reach out to your enemies and get them to vote. Not necessarily your political enemies. I'm just saying like your personal people you don't like, but are similarly situated in terms of their politics. Get them to vote. And joining us this week, Digby from the blog Hullabaloo. Also on the program today, Andy Kindler. From andykindler.com and Mind Spiral and
Thought Spiral,
the witches of Waverly Place. I can't remember that show, but I saw him on it when Milo was a kid. Also on the program today, with midterm days away, will Trump's racism, xenophobia, and anti-immigrant pitch carry the day? Another way of putting that is just how racist are the Republicans. Meanwhile, right-wing attempt to smear Robert Mueller fails catastrophically. And has Mueller already subpoenaed Donald Trump? Google workers walk out over sexual harassment. And the Trump administration cancels a program to fight domestic terrorism. Meanwhile, in a tight Senate race in Arizona, the Green Party candidate endorses the Democrat. And revealed, the Jaworski report shows how Nixon was about to be indicted by a grand jury before he resigned. Interesting story as to why that came out now.
Love history.
Fed says reduced immigration could slow the U.S. economy. And a George W. Bush-appointed federal judge allows the continuance of the North Dakota Native American vote disenfranchisement campaign. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. It is November 2nd, as you are undoubtedly aware. What you may not be aware of is something that I was not aware of until Kyle, the guy who made this show possible, literally made this show possible. I think I've told the story a million times, but here is a million one. I was at Netroots Nation. It must have been the summer of 2010, after Air America imploded in the fall of 2009, Marin had launched WTF, I think, and I was trying to figure out what I was going to do. I was thinking about going back into show business, but I couldn't swallow pitching another dumb sitcom. And the last one I had pitched, CBS, they said they were going to buy it. They were going to make not a full pilot, but what do they call it? Presentations, or a half pilot, which I would have directed, written. And then the writer's strike hit. I ended up writing that that script for HBO. So I was about 6 months out from the last script I had written, and I was like, I can't bring myself to go and pitch a show. I just couldn't. Too dumb, the stuff at that time. And I had been shooting some videos. I think the That's Bullshit. And this guy comes up to me at Netroots Nation. He says, I'm Kyle. I'm like, Kyle, right. I remember you used to IM us. And he was the one who also had reserved AdNags, which became the secret blog of Adam Nagorny in 2004. Which I and a couple other folks, I think Kyle maybe a little bit as well, populated as a way of tormenting him back when blogs were something that were, you know, magical. And we made this blog as if Nagorny thought it was his own private blog that he was just writing to his fellow reporters. And it was a little bit catty. Anyways, Kyle said, you know, you should do a podcast. And I said, well, you know, I would, but I really, one of the things I really like about doing radio is taking phone calls, and I wouldn't be able to do that. He goes, oh, I can set that up for you. I was like, well, really? And he goes, yeah, I'll do I'll set up the website for you too. And I'll help you, you know, just make the podcast. All you got to do is
help with connectivity.
Yeah, exactly. He'll help with connectivity. And I'll just help you. And all you need to do is, you know, figure out how to actually get microphones and stuff like that. And I said, well, I lifted half the stuff from Air America anyway. So, I mean, I have that sitting in a box. And so the show was born. The first show was 8 years ago tomorrow on a Wednesday, November 3rd, it was a, you know, it was basically a soft launch. I don't think even in the show description I'm looking at now, this was the show description to the Majority Report with Sam Cedar on Wednesday, November 3rd, 2010. Now, of course, I had been doing this, the first Majority Report was in February at some time in 2003 on The Best Show with, Tom Sharpling, who tweeted out something really disgusting today about Andy Kindler's appearance. But we'll talk about that later. But meanwhile, this was the show description. I will read it to you. Sounds pretty exciting. Shows will be a bit sporadic for the next week or two as we organize ourselves. But when they happen, they will happen at 11:30 a.m. Eastern. Podcasts will be available shortly. More info soon. That was the description of the show.
Under promise and over deliver.
Exactly. And then on Thursday, the 4th, things really picked up. On today's show, what's next for Democrats and George W. Bush? Torture, criminal, and dimwit. Casual Friday was, we just did a replay of the original, the first Majority Report on Air America. And then, let's see. Well, nothing too... We didn't really get into show descriptions until a couple of months. But happy birthday to us.
It's your birthday. Happy birthday. It's your birthday.
We're not going to get hit for rights. Is
nope, this is public domain.
Public domain. There we go. There you go, folks. Happy birthday to all of you. I want to say thank you to our members. I don't thank our members enough, it's not because I'm not grateful. It's just I'm, I guess, rude and out of touch. But I want to thank our members. I think we started doing members sometime in February of 2011, and a lot of longtime listeners stepped up and made it possible to do this show. And at that time, too, I want to thank Dorsey and Evan. Dorsey, who I think now still works at BuzzFeed, just came to me and he was like, I'll help you set up the show. I'm like, I don't know how much I can pay you. He said, I don't care. He just did it. And so it's our members who make this show possible. And I am very grateful for the opportunity. And, you know, it can be trying at times, but it's a very gratifying way to make a living. Excuse me. And someday I'll be more professional about coughing into a microphone. Play some music quick while I drink.
Happy birthday to you.
I'm not getting choked up. I'm just, for whatever reason, something went down the wrong pipe. So what? There's an interesting dynamic that's going on. What's that? Yeah, some water would be great. Thank you. Our crew has got really professional, too. There's an interesting dynamic that is going on with this election. Excuse me. And that is, how much is racism going to sell across the board? And we'll talk more about this with Digby. But here is a student going and challenging the Steve King, the Iowa congressman, who has basically run on and been a lightning rod for white nationalism in this country. And he has gotten more explicit over the past couple of years, I think. And, of course, he feels more comfortable doing so now in the age of Trump because Donald Trump is a white nationalist. And so here a student goes and asks Steve King at, I guess I'm not exactly sure if this was a press conference or
a candidate forum.
Steve King could see this guy walking in. He was wearing flannel. How do you distinguish yourself from the white nationalists who shot up this synagogue in Pittsburgh, killed 11 people because he was afraid of the immigrant hordes who were being, who were about to invade this country, being prodded on by the Jews? How do you distinguish yourself, your ideology from his? I mean, it's quite evident that Steve King has not shot up a temple full of Jews. He's a congressman. But how do you distinguish your ideology, he's asked. And I guess Steve King didn't feel comfortable answering the question.
And the terrorist who committed this crime, he was quoted as saying, "They bring invaders in that kill our people. I can't sit back and watch our people get slaughtered." You, Steve King, have been quoted as saying, "We can't restore our civilization with other people's babies." You and the shooter both share an ideology that is fundamentally anti-immigration.
Do not associate me with that shooter. I knew you were an ambusher when you walked in the room, but there's no basis for that, and you get no questions,
I was about to ask you what distinguishes your ideology.
We don't play these games here, Iowa.
I was about to ask you what distinguishes your ideology.
You crossed the line. It's not tolerable to accuse me to be associated with a guy that shot 11 people in Pittsburgh. I am a person who has stood with Israel from the beginning. The length of that nation is the length of my life.
I was about to
say, I've been with them all along, and I will not answer your question, and I'll not listen to another word from you.
If you don't have a white supremacist worldview, then why did you travel to Austria and work with the white supremacist organization?
I think he's given his answer. I think that his answer is his answer. Yes,
but do you identify as a white supremacist?
Sir, stop it.
Then why did you meet with the white supremacist organization in Austria?
They're done. I would ask whoever is guarding this door to lead this man out of the room.
Yeah.
I live and work in the 4th District. My wife lives and works in the 4th District.
There you go. Steve King traveled, was it to Poland to visit, I think it was Dachau. Maybe it was Auschwitz. I'm not sure. And then also, just to get the other side, met with a Holocaust denier. Just to, you know, fair and balanced. and uncomfortable, though, describing why his or how his ideology is any different from the one that led that shooter to kill those people. This is, well, that's a different one, right? That's Sneem Knight. So there it is. Well, I guess we'll know if King gets reelected. He is in a very tight race with a pretty progressive guy. And there is, you know, the Republican Party has expressed, at least some people in the Republican Party have expressed a little uncomfortability with just how outwardly fascist Steve King is. So there's a slight movement there. But it also could be the case that they need to redeploy some of their assets in other races. So this is a good way to sort of justify not saving Steve King's seat. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Digby will be joining us to talk about what's happening out there three business days before the election. We'll be right back. We are back, ladies and gentlemen. It is Casual Friday. And, we've had a recent spate of musically talented people providing all sorts of fare for just a moment like this.
Are you ready for some pee-pee? Yeah. Are you ready for some pee-pee?
Well, you know, it's a little AM talk radio-y from like 1971, I think. Heather Parton, Digby, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. AM radio 1971 is probably just perfect for me, actually.
I have to say that it reminds me of my early youth. Around that time, I started recording stuff off of radio with like one of those Panasonic. Do you remember those like molded almost look like one piece of plastic cassette players?
Oh, yeah. I think I had one of those, actually.
Yeah, all the
cool
kids
did. Cassettes were kind
of
cool, right? I mean,
yeah,
they were the big new thing. I mean, that was exciting. Small, you know.
No more 8-tracks.
Yeah. Oh, well, you know what? I never had an 8-track. And I have to say, I mean, I am of the age that should have, but, you know, I was too cool for that. I went directly from vinyl to cassettes. That's how forward-thinking I was.
All right. Well, okay. That's pretty impressive. Let's get to. I think my folks had the 8-tracks. I probably just went to cassettes too. Digby, let's start with this because it seems to me there's a fascinating dynamic that's happening in terms of these house races, right? And let's just and folks are going to hear this refrain, I think, multiple times going forward, but. The Democrats need 23 seats. There are, you know, and my numbers are a little bit loosey-goosey here, but about 15 of these seats or so are, you know, districts that Clinton won, but, you know, suburban Republican voters on some level or with a propensity to vote Republican, they have a Republican congressperson, and they seem to be, those are races that seem to be more of a lock for the Democrat. Lock may be too strong of a word, but certainly Democrats up. And then there's like another like two dozen, maybe even more, 30 seats that are, you know, it's nobody can call. It's too close. And those tend to be ones where there it's not as suburban. Maybe the districts are not as wealthy. And it seems like Trump is focusing on those. And because they also sort of track a little bit more with the red states where there are Senate races that Trump wants to hold. Is that your sense? And what do you think about the idea of the way that they're going about trying to salvage that seems to be to just go all in racist, quasi-fascist. Maybe not quasi.
Not so quasi at this point. But, yeah, I think you're right. I think, I think most of the analysts sort of see that Trump, and from what I'm reading, and there was an article in Vanity Fair this week that was kind of interesting where they were talking to, where they were quoting Trump's pollster, who I think is his name Tony Fabrizio, I think. I'm sorry if I've got that name wrong. Fabrio or Fabrizio, something like that. Anyway, he had sort of convinced Trump that there was that they had a chance to take back the House. And the article sort of implied that they were kind of blowing smoke at Trump, right, kind of making him feel better because they sort of knew that the chances were pretty bad even at this point, which was maybe a month ago. Then, and so Trump was all excited and very happy and feeling really motivated, and he was out there really pushing, you know, doing his rallies and going up against the press and being very, you know, doing his thing. And then these two horrible events happened last week. Hard to believe it was just last week. I mean, you know, when you think about it, Pittsburgh, it hasn't even been a week since
right.
that happened, and yet, you know, whatever, but, you know, life comes at you fast in the Trump era. But when that happened, he got very upset and about his momentum, which he mentioned last night in a rally again, that, you know, it really ruined his momentum, ruined his plans, and that was really upsetting. And they came back to him and said, hey, look, you know, the House is gone. And I think some of that was probably his people sort of saying, look, this is the way to sort of, you know, break it to him that the House isn't going to happen. So basically, I think what you're talking about with his strategy, where he's going, it's into these red states where they think they can hold the Senate and maybe some of those seats that are within that sort of region and area where he'll get a lot of coverage and maybe he can help out some of those people. Now, I read an interesting quote the other day, or read an interesting sort of analysis that Trump had down when he went to Texas to stump for Cruz and he had that big rally in Houston. The Cruz people think he hurt them because the poll started to move up for Beto O'Rourke after he came. So, you know, even in Texas, maybe Trump is starting to get a little toxic, which I found kind of interesting. But, you know, he's doing his thing. I mean, he's going out there, and yes, his strategy entirely is to just double down as hardcore as he can on the anti-immigrant, xenophobic, anti-media, you know, every kind of harsh, ugly, you know, sort of strategy that he thinks got him where he is. I mean, he said that. He, in this interview with Axios, which I guess is going to premiere this weekend on HBO, they you know, published some excerpts from it. And he just said, well, you know, this is what people want from me, and it's my only way of fighting back. This is why I won. And I think that says it all for him. I mean, I think that's the, you know, he just has a very, very limited sort of understanding of politics. And it's, I won because, you know, I'm a nasty bastard and I fight back, and, you know, everybody hates the media. And it doesn't really get any more complicated than that. The problem is that, you know, Trump had you hate to say it's an opportunity, but there was a moment that he could have potentially reached out to some of those suburban voters that you were talking about at first, you know, the people who they think are probably gone, and some of these people who, you know, may have been in, you know, districts that Hillary won, or maybe some of these, you know, white suburban women who have been Republicans their whole lives, but now they're voting Democratic. They say they are in this election, because after those two tragedies last week, he had, you know, he could have, and apparently his staff approached him and said, you know, we should do an Oval Office speech where you talk about unity and bringing the country together. And everybody would, you know, think about it. People would have been shocked, kind of like, geez, Trump doesn't do this, you know, and if he could have pulled it off and acted it halfway decently, who knows? Maybe some of those people or some of the independents who lean Republican could have gone, well, you know, maybe Trump's not so bad, you know, when the chips are down, he can come through and he's not quite the horrible jerk that we thought he was.
Certainly there would be a lot of media people who would have said, like, this is the day he really, really became president.
He made the pivot.
Right? I mean, honestly, we know that would have happened. And
yeah, of course.
I mean, he's just...
Of course, they yearn for it.
He's not constitutionally capable of it.
No.
And I wonder... I mean, here's the thing. I don't know that he's wrong. Like, you know, that's... I mean, that counter sort of like factual scenario, that may have helped him, but it also may have hurt him. Like, you know, I mean, I don't know. I mean, that's the thing about this midterm that I think has the potential to be super, super dark. I mean, aside from, you know, the idea of the Republicans controlling the House and the Senate, the way in which they win, if they were to somehow maintain the House, let's say, the winning in that way would be really disturbing. I mean, let's look at this video. Clearly, Trump is all in on this strategy of basically a sadistic, I promise you, I will be the guy to oversee the U.S. government shooting, you know, snipers on some type of imaginary wall, shooting would-be asylum seekers, you know, as they try and come approaching the wall. I mean, this is basically what he's going on and doing. It's all a complete straw man, right? We know the caravan, to the extent that there's going to be anybody left in this so-called caravan by the time they reach the Mexico border, they're not going to be here for months. There's no doubt in my mind that we're not going to hear anything about this in 2 weeks unless the Republicans win retain the House. But here is Donald Trump talking about what the plan is.
I hope not. I hope not. It's the military. I hope there won't be that. But I will tell you this. Anybody throwing stones, rocks, like they did to Mexico and the Mexican military, Mexican police, where they badly hurt police and soldiers of Mexico, we will consider that a firearm. Because there's not much difference when you get hit in the face with a rock, which, as you know, it was very violent a few days ago, very, very violent. That break-in, it was a break-in of a country. They broke into Mexico. And you look at what's happening in Guatemala, just to mention Guatemala, along with El Salvador and Honduras. It's disgraceful that those countries aren't able to stop this, because they should be able to stop it before it starts. And the United States pays them a fortune. And we're looking at not doing that anymore, because why should we be doing that when they do nothing for us?
So now it turns out that the military was not aware of this change in orders, that most of their weapons were not going to be used. Like, literally, most of their weapons were going to be under lock and key. Like, this is clearly Mattis is saying, okay, we'll send 5,200 military personnel to the border, and they're just going to hang out. Like, this is going to be like an R&R situation. But put that aside for a moment. He is calling for the U.S. Army to fire on immigrants in the event that they have rocks in their hands.
Yes, that is what he did. And in fact, he later went on in that same sort of Q&A after his silly speech yesterday. He went on to say that he had told the military to change that order, and that he was telling them, consider it a rifle if somebody's throwing a rock at you. Now, I mean, you know, this is obviously, I mean, there are a million laws that are going to be in force at this. The idea that, and I don't even know what the thinking in the military is, from what I read yesterday and saw people sort of talking about, they're of different minds within the military about whether or not this operation, what are they calling it? Patriotic Eagle or something? I don't know. Something should be called Operation White Supremacy.
Right.
But they're of different minds about whether or not this is, you know, a good use of their time, effort, and resources. And it's going to be very, very expensive. It's going to cost billions of dollars. You know, the only thing Trump will ever write a blank check for is the military. And you know, the idea that this something terrible could happen as a result of this is obvious. I mean, you know, look, I don't want to, you know, digress too far here, but you only have to think about, you know, the Gaza and the West Bank to think about how rock throwing turns into tragedy.
Of course.
Even on our own border,
well,
in the past, there have been incidents like this with the military back in the late 90s. They had the military they used to send troops to the border. This isn't the first time a president's done this, but it was always under the auspices of trying to stop drug trafficking. Never before has it been to stop a bunch of, you know, ragtag group of mothers and their children at the border. I mean, that's just never been done before. But there have been troops there, and there was a terrible incident in the late 90s where a soldier who was deployed on this drug mission accidentally shot a young goat herd, unarmed, you know, Mexican kid who accidentally crossed the border tending his goats. And it was a terrible thing. And, you know, it really made people think twice about whether or not you ever want to do it. Now, George Bush did. He sent a bunch of troops down to the border, 2,000, I think, or maybe it was 6,000. I can't remember, but it was a lot. And it cost billions of dollars, his operation did. So, you know, this gambit isn't new, which is why I think maybe Mattis is going along with it. He's a little more acquiescent than people sort of expected him to be, because it has been done before. This is a different atmosphere, right? I mean, we are in Trump is building people up into a frenzy. And I don't know if he's building U.S. military troops up into a frenzy. He probably is building the Border Patrol up into a frenzy. And I can guarantee you that all these militia guys who are going to come down
right,
and, quote, help, he's definitely building them up into a frenzy. So you're setting up a situation for something very tragic to happen.
And
I think maybe he wants that, to be honest.
I think that's very possible. And we should also say, you know, there are greater implications, and we're starting to see more and more of this, right? Bolsonaro elected in Brazil. Now he's moving the embassy to Jerusalem in the Brazilian embassy. And just today, the Nigerian army, which this week shot and killed multiple protesters who were throwing rocks, under investigation. This is their biggest defense. They tweeted out that video that we just played, please watch and make your deductions, essentially saying, look, the president of the United States says if you throw rocks, it's like firing weapons. Therefore, we cannot be held to account for shooting unarmed protesters. And this is, you know, for you know, we had been asking for, you and I had been talking about in the lead up to, you know, after the, you know, to the inauguration and sort of contemplating what are the implications of foreign policy? You know, this is one of those things. We see this time and time again where, you know, I don't think as citizens, you know, just going about our daily basis, particularly, you know, people who may be a little bit jaded, as, you know, a lot of folks are, we're conscious of that the United States, in many respects, maintained, even though there was times we were certainly hypocritical about it, but maintained some type of normative values in the world that had some type of restraining impact on other governments around the world. And we're seeing what happens when we sort of let go of those, you know, where we create a little bit of slack in those type of normative values.
Oh, a lot of slack. I mean, I would say it was a lurch. You know, it was kind of an abrupt change. You know, I think you and I have talked about this a lot. You know, this kind of the scary sort of aspect of this. Of, you know, it's all scary. What he's doing domestically is very scary. But we don't know yet whether or not our institutions have the resilience to be able to resist this. And we'll see on Tuesday our first sign of whether or not it's actually possible. Because the Republican Party, of course, is, you know, they've proved that they are not going to be part of that. That institution is dead, so we can't really count on them. But maybe the vote will do something anyway to give us hope that we can bring that back. But on an international level, we just do not know what the result and the consequences of this man being president is going to be. It's very, very up in the air. It's unknown. And that is a very scary thing, because as much as we thought, you know, many of us have said for years that, you know, hey, the U.S. being the policeman of the world is not a good position to be in, being the world's only superpower, blah, blah, blah. You know, that this is it's putting the country in an immoral position. It empowers, you know, all kinds of terrible consequences around the world. But you don't pair that up with nothing to replace it. I mean, the idea was always, okay, we need to create new institutions. We've got to find new alliances. We've got to build on, you know, some kind of global understanding. You can't just walk away. And that's basically what Trump has done. And not only has he walked away in terms of, you know, giving any kind of respect toward the international order that had been built after World War II, but, you know, he's also just sort of joined the petty tyrant club. You know, he might as well be Duterte, or I think he's going to be a lot like Bolsonaro. I mean, these are the kinds of ugly, you know, sort of, you know, petty sort of international relations that lead to wars. I mean, that's the sort of thing that he's doing. And, you know, we have to keep our eyes on that all the time, because we don't know where the chips are going to fall with that. It's very, very dangerous. And here we have him, you know, modeling for the rest of the world, the United States of America, you know, doing things like, you know, saying the new rules of engagement are to shoot at rock throwers. And we're seeing the results instantly in a place like Nigeria. I mean, this is really sounding extremely dangerous. It's one reason why, you know, the Congress, they can't do a lot, but they do have a voice. And if we do manage to take back the House, and, you know, I guess that there's a long shot that they might take the Senate, unlikely, but you never know. That suddenly there's another force within the United States that can be, you know, use its voice to somehow project out to the world, hey, look, this guy does not have unlimited power. He doesn't, or he shouldn't, but under the Republicans, of course, he has. There's been zero oversight, and if anything, they've been working as his accomplices in the Congress.
I think it's obviously a Democratic Congress mitigates what Trump does. But in terms of the message sent to the rest of the world, I'm not sure you get that. I don't think there's any takesies backsies on this one. Do you know what I mean? I think like the message to the world is, I just don't know that we ever regain that type of, you know, even the illusion of that type of moral authority. You know, I don't want to overstate, you know, I say that with all the caveats that are involved in that, right? But it just makes it a harder argument for, you know, there's a reason why Ben Salman is really going to just be okay in Saudi Arabia, right, in, you know, another 3 or 4 weeks. There's a reason why the business class in Brazil didn't feel too bad about electing an out-and-out fascist. The Nigerian military, they're all getting their justification. And we should also say there's also, like, domestically, right? Like, this stuff, we're watching it with our own eyes. There, you know, all the data points are that there is more racism, hate groups are acting out. Maybe there aren't more racists, but there are more who are crossing the threshold in and out of the shadows, as it were. I don't know how you put that back in the bottle. Like, a society can do that, I think, over time, in terms of those racists and xenophobes, if things turn over the next couple of years. But in terms of the rest of the world, like, I think once you sort of step down as that, you know, providing that normative value, it seems to me very hard to sort of regain it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, the most we can hope for, really. I totally agree with you on that. Things are, you know, I mean, I hate to say this because it's scary, but, you know, it's not, it shouldn't be too scary, is that things are never going to be the same, okay? I mean, this changed. This was it. And it had been happening for a long time, right? I mean, our democracy has been in trouble for, you know, at least 30 years, probably longer. Our institutions have been, you know, corrupted. I mean, we know all that. We've been watching this happen through our lifetime, that something was wrong, we knew. And this is just sort of the zenith of that, and we're seeing it happen. But that doesn't mean that it necessarily has to be a completely negative, you know, horrific Mad Max replacement, right? I mean, there theoretically could be some kind of new world order put in place that, you know, could actually be better, and be better for the United States. I mean, the United States should not, after this much time, after the war, it made sense for the United States to sort of bear the burden and be the, you know, the single power that sort of kept the world on an even keel. But that made no sense after a certain time, and certainly after the Soviet Union broke up. So, you know, it's fair to say that something new should be in place, and it's not impossible to believe that something new can be built that is actually good and better than what we had before. But there's no guarantee of that. And with Donald Trump in office, it's impossible to believe, because he's an incompetent imbecile who is, you know, driven by a bunch of primitive emotions, and that's about it. So it's not going to happen with him. And the way that the world looks with these, you know, with these people in power, I mean, you've got Putin, you've got Xi, look what's happening in Europe. I mean, that is not a good sign. You've got Bolsonaro here, and you've got us, and this is, you know, this is a bad sign. These are very powerful countries that are all kind of going in the wrong direction. So, you know, I don't mean to sound like, you know, kumbaya, that, oh, gosh, everything is fine. But it's theoretically possible. But, you know, the problem is that the United States is an economic and military powerhouse. It's the one. It's got the, you know, the biggest military in the world. We spend more on our military than all the other countries combined. That still is real, and that's a very dangerous thing for us, because, you know, if we become a threat, you know, bad things can happen. And I think a lot of people in this world are starting to see us as at best a competitor rather than an ally, and at worst an enemy. And, you know, this is not a good thing. And I don't know, you know, it really requires people to be, you know, take this seriously. It's not, you know, Donald Trump seems like a clown, but he is a clown, but an evil clown, and he has to be taken seriously, even though it's kind of, you know, hard to do so sometimes.
All right. Well, let's pivot to just how seriously people are going to take things in 5 or 6 days. I mean, the midterm elections, obviously, there's a tremendous sort of like generic secular, if you will, disadvantage to Democrats in this cycle in terms of the Senate. There are, I think, it's 2/3 of the incumbents who are facing re-election are Democrats. So the Democrats had far more to defend. A lot of the races, though, in terms of the Senate, are not, you know, we go back 2 years ago, we talk about people who we think could have problems, right? Like Sherrod Brown or, Tammy Baldwin in Wisconsin, folks, you know, in the Midwest, broadly speaking. I mean, you know, Donnelly's still in trouble. Manchin seems to be okay. Heidi Heitkamp, obviously, having some problems. But sort of the solid Democrats in the Midwest, in states that are sort of purpley states, that people thought might be problematic, are not. I don't know what that tells us about their candidacies as much as it might tell us about the states or people, you know, being disaffected with Donald Trump. But there's definitively a hardening, it seems to me, of people's positions, right? Because Trump wouldn't feel like he could go out and do this. He thinks he's strengthening himself, at least in terms of the Senate, right, by doing this, or at the very least hardening the ramparts, or, you know, I guess fortifying the Alamo, as it were. I mean, by all appearances, it's going to work. Brett Kavanaugh did not hurt them. It seems to have helped on some level, at least in the red states.
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that, you know, if you look at the polling and even Donald Trump's approval rating, I mean, he's really strange that way. Most presidents have some play in their approval rating depending on what's going on, and his has been very, very narrow. I mean, the only good part about that is that he starts out very low for a president, you know, right around 40%, and it just stays there. So that says to me that, you know, I mean, his base of support is pretty solid. I mean, it really is. But as somebody pointed out, I think maybe it was James Fallows from The Atlantic, that, you know, Herbert Hoover got 40% in 1932, right, in the depth of the Depression. There's always a base of the opposing party, right, no matter what is happening. So we shouldn't be too surprised by that. And the fact that, you know, the way that our politics are sort of shaking out in this polarized era is in these red states. I mean, they tend to be sort of states with a big rural population, and that is a place where you find, you know, the hardest core Trump voters, the people who really like him and are, you know, approving of the Republican Party's acquiescence to him, which is why they're voting for Republicans. They like that. And, you know, as we know, going into this election, and we knew this 2 years ago, we knew it 4 years ago, that this map was going to be very, very difficult for Democrats. And I even remember, and you probably recall this too, 2 years ago, looking at the House map, people were really, you know, pessimistic about the Democrats' ability to take the House because it, with all the gerrymandering and all the districts, the way that they were laid out, it did not look very likely that Democrats could do it if the Republican, you know, president was able to, you know, hold on to at least a few of his coattails. And the Senate, of course, was just considered a write-off. There was never any change. You know, what are we talking about? Let's forget that. The Democrats weren't just going to not gain any seats. They were going to lose a bunch of seats, as you just pointed out. And that would have included somebody like Sherrod Brown or Tammy Baldwin after 2016, because you would have thought that was Trump country. So, you know, I don't you know, I think it's hardening, but I'm not sure it's hardening in a way that is to their benefit. And I'm not sure that Trump is doing them any favors because, you know, one of the things that he just does not understand is that for every one of his, you know, red hats at his rallies, you know, there's a couple other Republicans out there that are repulsed by what he's doing. And he, you know, he needs to think a little bit about that. Now, most Republicans are backing him. But what is it? It's like 80%? I mean, that's not unanimous. And I suspect his big problem is the Republican leading independents, right? And they're falling the other way this time.
Well, I mean, there's a couple of things about this that strike me. One is that it's Fallows is right? 40%, although George W. Bush fell below 40%, I think, if I remember. He was in the mid to low 30s at one point for a considerable period of time. It suggests to me a couple of things. One, Donald Trump might be sui generis in terms of the threat that he constitutes in terms of like our status around the world or our ability to get into a sort of knee-jerk, horrible conflict. But fundamentally, he is aligned with the Republican Party. Like he is not distinct from Republicans in any shape or matter. I mean, it appears to me, right? Because he's doing quite well in the most Republican of areas. I mean, you know, we talk about his national approval rating is going up, inching up a little bit. But in some states, like he's well above 50% because they are Republican dominated states. On top of which, I mean, the other thing that occurs to me about this is that those Republican suburban voters who are abandoning him or supposedly abandoning him, they've got their tax cuts, right? And there's a couple of social things that they say, hey, I think this has gone too far. But I wonder how, obviously we need those voters for the for the midterms. And I hope, though, that Democrats and, you know, Nancy Pelosi has an agenda that is, you know, for Congress that I didn't, maybe it's in there. I didn't see voting rights. You know, there's not the things on the agenda are not those things that should edify Democratic power to the extent that there is Democratic power. Now, obviously, they can't pass anything if there's a Republican Senate. But, you know, you're setting the table. There's a reason why you do these things. They should be edifying Democratic power within their Democratic base, right? Like, ensure voting rights. Let's try and help out unions. And I worry that those Republican voters who are with us today, because Donald Trump is an offensive human being, won't necessarily be there 2, 4, 6 years from now if there's an attempt to sort of reprioritize where, let's say, the money expended on those tax cuts go.
Well, and let's just look at it from a purely, you know, cynical political basis. The bigger the tent gets, right, the bigger the Democratic coalition, you suddenly start bringing in a bunch of, you know, former Republicans into the tent. You suddenly got a bunch of conflict within the tent because these aren't people that necessarily, they're not Bernie Sanders people, okay? So, you know, we're going to have, I hope everybody's prepared for this. I mean, this is going to be a big battle. Now, I'm hopeful that it's not going to happen within the next 2 years. My suspicion is that the focus will be on Trump. I suspect that you'll have an agenda that includes all those things that you're talking about, as well as, you know, stuff like, you know, reversing the tax cuts and doing a bunch of other things. I mean, they can't actually do it, but they'll talk about it, you know.
You're setting it up, right? You're setting it up.
Yeah, set it up. And, of course, you've got a very, what is going to be a contentious presidential primary among a bunch of Democrats who are running from all over the country, everywhere. And that's all going to be sorted out, and it's going to be very public, and we're going to have that argument going into the presidential race. But I think that people will be focused for 2 years on defeating Donald Trump in 2020, and that will probably, you know, somehow sort of tamp down whatever, you know, true disagreements exist on any kind of sort of vitriolic level. I'm hopeful anyway, because I think it's probably better. I think we should have the argument, but I think it should be pretty, you know, hopefully it will be something that's kind of, you know, civil and understandable, and there's not a lot of hard feelings this time. And Donald Trump, I think, will tend to focus the mind better than anything else. But, you know, this is going to happen. I mean, when you bring in a bunch of Republicans into the Democratic Party, there's going to be a bunch of you know, there's going to be definite pressure to adhere to take on more conservative policies.
Right.
They're more conservative people, right? I mean, so that's going to happen, and it's fine. You know, that we can. I think that the party can handle it, but I think that people like us, we're going to be in a position of having to fight very hard for what we believe in on the progressive side, and make sure that we don't get into that thing, because money plays a big part in that.
Yep.
And that's one thing where I think is really important. What we're seeing in this election for the first time, I think, and it's really setting an example of how powerful this grassroots fundraising is. I mean, these Democratic candidates, a lot of them are not taking any kind of PAC money. I'm not saying they're not being helped on some level by outside groups that are doing ads and things like that. But just on a pure fundraising level, these people are doing really well just with grassroots fundraising. And it's providing a model for how the Democratic Party can go forward. And if progressives, that's one area I think progressives should push hard, which is, you know, no PAC, none of this corporate, you know, corporate fundraising. We're not doing it anymore. And that will take some of the pressure off on taking on some of these conservative views. They won't be quite as likely to be, you know, running around catering to, you know, CEOs and Wall Street, hedge fund managers.
Not quite. We're up against it, but I want to touch on this for just a couple of minutes, because I have a feeling we're going to be talking about this. You know, we talk again in a couple of weeks. We're going to be talking about this. The other day, Benjamin Wittes, another guy from Lawfare, another guy, Bates, who was on the Ken Starr investigation, they were responsible for a FOIA request. Maybe it was a FOIA request. I'm not exactly sure. Where some archives were released. They were from the Nixon era. And these archives, it was the Watergate roadmap. It was notes from Leon Jaworski, I think. And it also, it was Jack Goldsmith and Benjamin Wittes. Those are, and Stephen Bates. And the U.S. archives released these court documents that show a federal grand jury in February of 1974 was prepared to indict Richard Nixon. Talks about the subpoenas, talks about the draft of the indictment, and there was a roadmap that was developed. Part of it was with the help of Archibald Cox, who at that point had been, you know, fired by Nixon. Part of it was by Jaworski, and part of it was written by the judge who was overseeing this stuff. And all this stuff had basically been put away, archived. And these guys worked, they petitioned for the documents to be released. Now, I don't know why they were released now, right? As opposed to, like, this is a weird time, a couple of days before the election. But everybody anticipates Jeff Sessions to be fired, after the election, and maybe other things happening. There's another piece out there that suggests that maybe Mueller has already issued a subpoena to Trump. I think you told me before we got on that Marcy Wheeler, and I neglected to read Marcy before coming on the air today, which is always a huge mistake, but that Marcy Wheeler is not as convinced. But nevertheless, in the next, I have a real sense that in the next 6 weeks, as we get closer to Christmas in the new year, there's going to be a lot of like civic activity that is going to have to take place, right? I mean, do you have that sense too?
Yes, it sure feels that way. I mean, there's a lot of news starting to trickle out about Roger Stone and that whole side of it. Steve Bannon was called back into the grand jury. But as for the Nixon thing, just to briefly touch on that, that was really fascinating because what that document had been handed over to Congress at the time, and that was the basis that they used for their impeachment, impeachment document. And
the Articles of Impeachment.
The Articles of Impeachment, right. That had been used for that, and it had been kept secret this whole time. I mean, nobody from they wanted it to be secret. They kept it secret. It was grand jury stuff, right? I mean, you don't normally, I mean, that is the way it's supposed to work. The grand jury stuff is not supposed to be public. Ken Starr didn't care about that. He actually put Bill Clinton's grand jury testimony on television,
right?
Or actually Newt Gingrich did that. But regardless, and normal people, you know, they have respect for the secrecy of the grand jury. And this is very interesting. And what Wittes and company say is that what this does is provide a roadmap for Robert Mueller, which is very different than the Starr report, which I think is what people are kind of expecting to come out, that it's going to be some narrative, you know, with it, you know, like Ken Starr's bottom-ripping
right.
romance novel that he wrote. But that's not what this is. This is just the facts, ma'am. It's very, very, you know, Jack Webb. It's just very laid out. The grand jury, they laid it out point by point by point, and the simplicity of it is what impressed all the legal beagles who looked at this and went, whoa, you know, this is devastating on a legal basis. And they didn't make any conclusions. They didn't say, you know, look, this is what we think is impeachable. This isn't, blah, blah, blah. They didn't say anything like the Ken Starr report. It was just, these are the crimes that we think are indictable. And we would indict him if he were not president. I mean, that's basically, because Jaworski had convinced that many of the grand jury, apparently, majority of the grand jury, wanted to indict the president. They felt there was evidence there, and Jaworski convinced them to call him an unindicted co-conspirator instead, which is devastating enough for a president, and that's really what put him over the edge and made it necessary for him to resign. But, you know, this is a pretty amazing document. I sort of, you know, I'm not a lawyer, so, you know, looking at it, I couldn't really tell how devastating the actual legal implications are. But just the volume of it, it's like 52 pages, very spare, but it's one thing after another. And these are, many of them are things that we are aware of, most of them are, that of what Nixon's crimes were. But when you see it laid out in that sort of a legal document, it's like, oh, you know, and if Mueller has something like that in mind for what's going to happen, I think this could be, it could be a real shocker.
It seems to me, though, the argument, I mean, what we're seeing is lobbying that is taking place in the legal community for mm-hmm. the legitimacy of something like this, right? And
yeah.
so the mm-hmm. idea is in the minds of these people, right, who are not necessarily my favorite people anyways. But in this instance, they're carrying a fairly important flag, I think, that the idea is they're putting pressure, it seems to me, right? Like they're putting this is like an audience of like one or two, right? Like they're putting pressure. This is them trying to put pressure on either the D.C. Circuit Court or probably the Supreme Court, right? Like,
yeah, I think
like,
it's John Roberts.
Right. I mean, if you like, they're basically saying to John Roberts, This is it. And now, like,
yep.
you know, we all knew these documents were out there. Not, you know, it, none of it's particularly new except for the sort of like the legal principles and the boxes you have to tick off along the way to do this. And John Roberts, you should be aware that history is now aware of this. So you're
yep.
going to be going against history, against what happened last time to a Republican president, you know, in a much less not a partisan era. And if you do this, understand, like, I don't know, I remember some like after school special or something on the signing of the Constitution, or I can't, maybe it was the Declaration of Independence. I mean, it was really, you know, stuff for like kids, but there was one guy, I can't remember if he was from Maryland or what, at the time, the representative, where everybody was like, do you really want to be the guy known for throughout it? Who was the one who didn't sign, because that's who you be. And on some level, this is like the legal establishment saying to John Roberts, here's your bar. Are you going to, you know, you can lean on precedent, or you can be the radical who down the road in American history, you're the one who let Donald Trump get off of this. I mean, this is going to be.
Are you going to be a hero or a villain? I mean, I think that's you know, pretty simple stuff. And I think that, you know, one of the things one of the people who came out was George Conway, Kellyanne Conway's husband. He wrote an op-ed with Neil Katyal, who is, you know, a Democrat, although he's, you know, very sort of centrist and weird, but nonetheless, they wrote an op-ed sort of, you know, defending Mueller on this basis as well. This is, you know, I think this is big, and I think it's meaningful, and you bring up the timing, and I think it was the circuit court judge, wasn't it Howell, who actually ruled that these had to be released right now. I mean, I think you're right that it feels as though the legal establishment itself is kind of, you know, they're sending out signal after signal after signal that somehow or another, you know, this is important, and if you want to preserve the justice system, the country, any form of legitimacy and credibility with this institution of our judicial system, you better take this seriously. And I think, you know, I'm sure that Mueller and his people are reading it and, you know, trying to figure out whatever their strategy is going forward. I mean, Marcy Wheeler has always said that, you know, that maybe Mueller wouldn't even write a report, that basically what he would do is he was going to indict people and lay out the case, much as this case was laid out against Richard Nixon in this thing, just in pure, you know, legal terms. No editorializing whatsoever about the meaning of it or anything else like Ken Starr did. Or basically, you know, it was actually Brett Kavanaugh was one of the authors of the Starr report, so, you know, we know where he stands. But, you know, I think this is a very interesting development. And like you, I also believe that the minute that the election is over, that we're going to start seeing some major activity on this front. And I think it's going to be very turbulent because, you know, I don't think any of us really know you know, the depth of Mueller's evidence and where he's going with this. I mean, there are lots of little clues, but I don't think we really, really know. So it could be very, very interesting over the next couple months.
Well, Digby, I'm sure we'll be talking more about this in the future. Thanks so much for your time today.
Oh, you bet. Oh, thanks. Everybody vote on Tuesday for sure.
Yes. All right. Thanks, Digby. All right, folks.
Bye.
We're going to take a quick break. Head into the Kindler Zone. Andy Kindler will be joining us in just a sec.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is Friday. We are 3 days away from, at least three business days away from a very, very important election. I know there's a lot of people who are out canvassing as we speak, who are listening to the show on their phones. And we have given them more reason to continue their hard work as they go about trying to make sure that their neighbors and people in their community vote. And now it's an opportunity to reward them with this.
With a Jew like Andy Kindler, you know you can't go wrong. His ancestors wrote the God Bless America song. A true Obama bot, Andy believes Obama can never be wrong. Yeah, AndyKindler.com. You made me laugh so hard, I had to write you your own theme song. Andy Kindler.
Yeah.
Andy Kindler.
Can you believe it?
I cannot believe it, sir. I am so glad that you're here with us. How are you, Andy? I should tell you
I'm doing good. I don't know what you've heard. Okay, I'm not going to be funny, I can tell.
I should tell you right now, both Jamie and Michael are out of the office. Jamie,
yeah, what is this? I finally tagged someone? I mean, God forbid, I don't even know who anybody's name. I barely remember your name. Now I tag everybody, and everyone's out of the studio?
Well,
what, is this a prank?
Jamie had, long-time plans to be on the road today. And Michael just, you know, didn't feel like coming in today, so...
Right. Why come in today? Why come in today when he... Because when you come to New York, we have to have coffee when you come to New York. But he can't show up on the day that I'm on the show, right?
You know, okay. Well... I don't want to make you not feel special, but there is no one who has ever been on the show where he hasn't tried to hook up with them socially.
Oh, that does not make me feel special.
Oh, well. Yeah,
heard that when Goebbels came on a trip years ago, he tried, I'm sorry.
Just about anybody who has been on the show or is mentioned on the show, I think Michael has reached out to for a coffee.
Well, I want to, it's unbelievable that Jamie's not there. Because I sent in the new Dennis Miller. I mean, I don't want to talk about Dennis Miller, but there's new Dennis Miller information. He's no longer going to be the political guy. He's going back to his roots, making references that aren't that funny, but people still laugh.
Well, that's that was the story. He's been doing all these interviews, it seems like.
I posted one from today.
There was one today.
Just 3 hours ago from the Kansas City Star.
Yeah, that was the AP. There was a story from the Wall Street Journal. I think this was about 3 weeks ago now. And everybody sent it to us. And they're like, you got to talk to Andy about this. I noticed that right after he had done that, after he had given that interview in the Wall Street Journal, I think it was, you know, he's still tweeting things. In that interview, Dennis Miller plans politics break after fake news special, which, of course, why wouldn't you break from politics now? Because there's not much going on.
It's not in the news. It's not in the news anymore.
And... It's not.
That makes me laugh. I didn't even think of that part of it.
Here.
Look, folks, I'm trying to be topical. Nobody wants to hear about the world blowing up now.
Click
trying
that,
to be topical.
Click that real. Okay, so here it is. This was a story that was back here. Send it to me because I'll be able to open it up. The headline is, after years on the right, Dennis Miller wants to find comedy's middle ground. Which is just, I mean, first of all, has there been a time where comedy has been more political? Like it's like that politics are more relevant, more important for comedians to talk about, or people are pissed about, it's just what a wholesale retreat from like the damage this guy has. I don't know if you can say that he's done or contributed to, but certainly tried to contribute to.
in this country.
Yeah, and he's a rich guy. He's a guy, I mean, he's got his finger on the pulse of what's happening in society from his mansion up in Santa Barbara, where he hides from everybody.
And he says in that the interview that's released, like he's socially liberal, but fiscally conservative, which is the dumbest dodge. Like, this is something that could actually fly. I feel like, you know, maybe you could get away with that like 15, 20 years ago. But that's such a joke now. Everybody knows that. First of all, how can you support, if you're socially liberal, how could you possibly support the Republican Party today?
Well, I mean, I'm starting to question whether he is social. Well, you know what he used to say? He used to say that he wasn't anti-gay and, you know, all that kind of stuff. That's what he was. That's his idea of being socially liberal.
Right, right. Like, I don't have views from the 1950s, and I also believe that it shouldn't be illegal for white people and black people to marry.
Yeah, I even think with gay, like if I used to listen to him all the time when he was on that right wing show on AM, because I just loved that. I was so fascinated, and he still was afraid to even say that he's not anti-gay. You know what I'm saying? When you get a barrage of calls, he still tried to be nice to horrible people.
Well, and he also doesn't seem to have, you know, he seems to have still a problem with, like, maybe immigrants. Let's play his special. And I got to say, like, this is from that Wall Street Journal piece. Why now?
The new special? New special, right?
Well, yeah, this is what he said. Like, why now? I don't think you want to be the last guy suggesting we play charades at the Hatfield-McCoy cookout. And
I don't understand one word in that sentence. And well, I know references.
He's explaining. let's listen to his. There's so much here. I'm getting
overwhelmed. I don't want to be the last guy at the Hatfield-McCoy Dodge City. I'll get out of Dodge by 10 meeting, right?
Well, let's play. Here's a clip of his new special, and then we'll talk about why he's getting
on
out
the other
of
side?
This.
Yeah, let's talk on the other side.
Yeah, let's talk
Sam.
On the other side. Okay, here we go. This is, what's the name of this special? Is it Comedy Dynamics, or is that just the name of his?
It's a fake news, real
company.
Jokes.
That's the name of the company.
That's the Comedy Dynamics. Fake news, real jokes.
Reference comic.
Yeah,
reference
here we comic. Go.
I think social media has allowed us to all come together as one and realize there was really no reason whatsoever for us to all come together as one. I have an idea for a reality show about hoarders with impeccable taste. Quite frankly, they shouldn't throw anything out. Took my nephew out to a small, tiny local circus. It was very disappointing. Turns out it was just a house that had been tenant for termite proofing.
Pause it.
Isn't the circus closed? The circus is closed, right?
Well,
there
I
is
was
no
gonna
more
say,
circus.
Doesn't it sound feel like that joke was written like literally like 35 years ago?
Yeah, I went to a flea circus and I didn't know there were that many fleas that could do a backflip.
Don't you get this sense that Miller was sitting in his study in a big leather chair, and he says to his probably poorly paid intern who he's using to assemble, like, he goes, like, Kevin, go down into the basement, go to the file cabinet, pull out all the stuff from the file cabinet that Eddie Driscoll wrote for me in 1989. And that's,
I'm going to make that investment in Joan Rivers' card catalog cabinet pay off, finally.
Exactly.
Her old,
like,
jokes.
Let's pull out the old ones. Who gives a crap? I'm too tired for this shit. And go ahead, let's.
Proofing. Can we make it as hard to get into our country as it is to get off your plane when it arrives early at the terminal?
That's a good one, right? Like,
church.
Pause it.
Yeah.
Like, there it is. Fake news. I like that they put fake news up after that, because now I know you shouldn't hold him to any type of standard about truth, but that's what he says he's up there, right? I'm truth telling. And
The fact is, it's very difficult to get into the country legally or without documentation. I mean, no matter what. And but he's socially liberal.
Yeah. As horrible as it is about people getting into the country, it's like he knows these people are going crazy about the idea of keeping brown people out of the country. They love that part of his act, who's ever coming to see him. But now let me put that aside now, and let me talk about do my Copernicus material.
Exactly. I brought out the airplane stuff, but I wanted to make it sound racist too, so here it is.
He's feeding, can you believe that he lies so much? He feeds right into their fears. It's easier to get into this country than it is to log on to America.
I mean, he's Donald Trump with a lot more sort of glibness, cleverness, and a past where he exhibited some modicum of talent. But at the end of the day, the messaging is exactly the same. Here, continue. Is there more? Fake news.
You can't trust journalists. You can't trust the New York Times. You're better off trusting the odometer readings and the Auto Trader, for God's sake.
Pause it. People don't really use the Auto Trader anymore.
Is that a metaphor? Is that a metaphor, Sam?
Do they still have the Auto Trader? It's like he still imagines people are buying this stuff from their local Piggly Wigglies instead of looking online. But let's see where
you might as well go to the Penny Saver from 1973 and try and buy a chest of drawers.
Yeah, are you still looking in the classified? Oh, wait a second. Go ahead.
The recycler.
You want to know how little a journalism degree matters? I have one.
I like, too, that they did the old thing with the way by stopping the music. Watch this. Here we go.
Yeah.
They punch it. Ready?
Traitor, for God's sakes. You want to know how little a journalism degree matters? I have one. I see Trump's obvious downside. I think we all do. I think he was born in Kenya.
I couldn't even laugh that loud if I was being tickled. I mean, I can't even believe he's born in Kenya. Ooh.
Yeah, you're talking about the black guy who's president. Oh, God.
You know what? He's 2 weeks away from going, Obama's like that fifth guy from Star Trek who goes down to the planet and then Ensign Pulver, he's all of a sudden disappears.
Let's go to what he wrote here. That he said in this interview at Wall Street Journal, because it's really important. Good. But offstage, he confesses that sometimes he dreams about escaping America's raging political divide, which, we should be clear, he certainly helped create. Right? He laments how polarized every spoken word of public discourse has become. I mean, grab me that frickin' doll that we have over here. And just listen to what he was saying 20 years ago when, you know, the idea that we shouldn't go and invade Iraq for no reason. You know, here it is. Thank you. You know, he's...
I hear some in the pro-choice movement decrying our use of preemptive warfare against terrorism. Hey, if it helps you get your head around it, don't think of it as warfare. Think of it as us choosing to abort terrorists.
All right, so there he is.
Didn't you see that joke come? I mean, he sets up the joke. He tells you the joke.
Yeah, no, his joke was pretty straightforward. This was him 20 years ago, the socially liberal guy telling...
Are you telling me that's from 20 years ago?
This doll was produced during the run-up to the Iraq War.
Oh, my God. He's always been a jerk.
This is the guy, I mean, when he talks about polarization in this country, he's going around saying, like, you can't trust the French, who incidentally were like, hey, why are we invading this country again? I mean, everything I'm telling you, there's a lot of young people who have no idea the toxicity that this a-hole, and I'm not, you know, I'm holding him here,
entered into the popular bloodstream. He was such a hero for the right, they made a doll about him.
You're so angry you can't even call him a reference comedian.
But at the end of the day, it is connected to a big friggin' bomb.
That's right. The U.S. has a long fuse, but it's attached to a big bomb. We killed hundreds of thousands of people in Iraq by our own Defense Department numbers.
Hey, what's going on back there?
Oh, yeah, he's laughing about the button that you press in the back of the doll. All right, so he writes, I'm going to get out of the nodding applause business and back into the involuntary laughter business. We saw what that entailed. Like, hey, at least he's not Kenyan. I'm trying what's called a reverse Marcel Marceau, where I imagine myself not to be in a box.
Why? Oh my God.
Why now? Why now? I don't think you want to be the last guy suggesting we play charades at the Hatfield McCoy cookout.
That's I'm still having that one looked up.
I know what the Hatfield McCoy thing is supposed to be.
Yeah, but they didn't have a cookout. That's what I'm saying.
Well, first of all, not only did the Hatfield McCoys not have a cookout, but right. Hatfield McCoy is supposed to be a fight that is meaningless, right?
Yes.
It's just as opposed to a fight as to what the future of the country is. And then what's the charades reference?
How could you even do a? Hey, it's like opening up your act with "I'll buy a vowel."
And he's not suggesting we play charades. He's one of the either the Hatfield or the McCoy, and he's shooting at people.
He is true, though. It's a little known historical note that the Hatfields did win because they did invite the McCoys to a fake cookout.
Unbelievable.
Right. And then when they were about to sit down, blam, blam, blam. Oh, he's the most unhappy person in the world. And it makes me so thrilled that he sits around still steaming. What happened? Why am I not back on the top of my game? I shouldn't have gone too political. This is why he says he's not funny anymore. Because he went political. He's not funny. That's what his problem
is. And the reason why he's not political anymore is because his gigs are drying up. Like his Bill O'Reilly sinecure is folded, and now he's just tired of everything. Here he is on, this is really amazing. This is him on the Larry King program as to why he became a conservative. Think of all the reasons why you might become a conservative in the early 90s, all right? Like, I started to dig into sort of economic questions, or I felt like there was a cultural problem in society. This is right around the time when in 1992 at the Republican convention where Dan Quayle is, or where I should say Pat Buchanan is talking about a culture war in the country. Dan Quayle is railing on Candace Bergen because her character on Murphy Brown was a single mother. Okay? And this is why he decided to become a conservative. You, Andy, wait. I want you to try and guess.
Because I would think taxes would be my first guess.
Right. Okay. Here he is explaining to Larry King. And this is actually present day, though, right? Like with him and Larry King.
It's like 3 weeks
ago. Okay, here it is. He's explaining why
he's on the prostate show.
Why he's becoming a conservative in the early 90s, 1 year after leaving Saturday Night Live.
Okay, Rob M. on Twitter. At what point in your career or personal life did you switch ideologies from a political perspective? You did switch.
Well, no. I've always been a pragmatist, but I do remember during Stockdale. That was a big thing for me. Ross Perot chose James Stockdale. And this guy was a guy who worked out a tap code system in the Hanoi Hilton. Kids who wanted to die overnight.
I was there with that whole selection.
He prays with him.
Great American.
Okay, he runs. Perot picks him because Perot's like, yeah, to me, Perot's crazy. It's like, I want to see him as president for half. I want to see how crazy he is when he meets the Queen of England and go, are you Ruth Buzzy? You know, he's just crazy. So when he picks Stockdale, I think I'll look into this guy. I read about Stockdale to the extent that I can. Then they start making fun of him because he has his first press conference and he looks wide-eyed and he's a deer in a headlight. And he says, well, I don't even know why I'm here. Boom, the liberals just weighed in on him, make fun of him. And I thought, this is getting too flashcardy here. They should invest a little more time in this. And I remember thinking, I'm not sure if I'm certain enough of my guesswork to be liberal anymore. I just started reading on things. Listen.
Pause it. Now, wait a second. Now, so
what? Wow.
So, first of all, Stockdale said it was during the VP debate. Who am I? Yeah. Why am I here?
He said. Who am I? Why am I here, right?
He decides to become a conservative because Saturday Night Live mocks the Admiral Stockdale.
Wouldn't that be why he would become a member of the Reform Party, maybe? That would make sense.
But he's also simultaneously saying liberals just look at a flashcard. They don't do any depth. And that's why I changed my political ideology because they were making fun of Stockdale. That seems to me to be like a flashcard reason. No?
Yeah. he just does show up. Show that he never really had any political bones anyway, because I think I've told you, like, Kevin Rooney wrote a lot of his political stuff. I think he's always been I'm beginning to think he's always been a nincompoop. But you told me this was a recent interview and he used Ruth Buzzy?
Well, to be fair, he was talking about Ross Perot saying Ruth Buzzy.
Oh, okay. I got it. That's better.
But I like how he says Ross Perot's crazy. And I left. I decided not to be a liberal because I thought it was all just people making fun of Stockdale.
I can't even believe. I am impressed, though, that he can remember that many details from 20 years ago.
Wait, here's
sounds like he's still plugged in. He's still plugged into the H. Ross Perot campaign.
This is his political prognosticating on that same Larry King show. Here, Dennis Miller is, you know, he's getting ready. He's giving all these interviews. I want to get out of politics, whatnot. And this is what he thinks is going to happen in 2020.
Some social media questions. Michael James on Facebook. In your opinion, who will be the 2020 Democratic nominee?
I think it's Avenatti is president, and either Kamala Harris or Cory Booker in the two slot. I don't know.
That's
obviously,
funny.
It's good, but can you imagine if last time on the Republican thing, it was a demolition derby? What's it going to be like on the Democrat part this side? It's so funny now. I tune in to TV shows for serious political discourse, and I watch press conferences and debates for comedy because they've flipped roles now.
There's no news anymore.
It's so when I think about who's queuing up already, but they are saying, and that Avenatti might be one of the front runners.
Oh my God!
Wow.
At least he's got some astute political observation. He's really plugged in. He tried that as, you know what's amazing? He tried that as a joke. And
yes.
Larry King didn't laugh, and then he goes, no, it could be Avenatti.
Right, exactly. He's almost can't stop laughing as he says that.
Man, Michael Avenatti and Kamala, as if Kamala Harris is like a joke person to bring up. Oh yeah, he went after Kamala Harris again. Oh boy,
it is weird that he's sort of fixated on Kamala Harris and Cory Booker will be there. His VP Avenatti's,
and he expected a big laugh from that. I think it's gonna be Michael Avenatti with Kamala Harris.
That one killed in my last special, so I don't know why
he's done
laugh,
though. I love that he's done though, don't you think?
Oh yeah, I like that. But here the best part about it is this: how long do you think it will be after? I mean, supposedly like his tour is going to be over, right? And then, I mean, his special is going to be out there.
in 6 weeks, nobody's going to be talking about his special anymore. His touring is to promote the special. It's not going to be. How long do you think it's going to be until he's back into politics again? Because he realized like that's the last place that he's selling any of his stuff.
That's a good bet. And I would say, 6 months he'll be back into the politics, or he will be retired.
Yeah, totally retired.
Totally retired. You never hear from him again. But no, he's too egomaniacal. He's got to be. He can't do that. He can't do that. Although maybe the other choice would be he goes back to the bathrobe shows.
To the what show? The bathrobe shows.
Yeah.
Is he still doing the Dennis Miller option, or did he opt out on that?
I think he opted out. You know what's amazing? There's nothing that he's probably done that you can't get now on YouTube. I think he was holding this stuff out. Yeah, if you subscribe to my show, you get some of my special never-before-seen basement tapes.
I noticed on your Twitter feed that you you may have watched the press conference with is it Jacob Wohl? The press conference, the smear Mueller?
I actually did watch it, but I hadn't watched it until I didn't know that name. That was like someone got me with a name, and I'm still a little confused.
Okay, so here's the story. This guy, Jack Berkman, who is a Republican operative, and another Republican, I guess, operative or conservative, like pro-Trump Twitter guy, Jacob Wohl, who's 20 years old, were announcing that they have a woman who claims that she was raped, right? Was it raped or sexually assaulted by Robert Mueller 20 or 30 years ago? And they got the information from Surefire Intelligence, which turns out to be Jacob Wohl's creation, where he created a website with all pictures that he stole from the internet to supposedly be his investigators. Like, there was the chief of the Israeli bureau was a Israeli supermodel,
Bar Rafaeli.
the head of Zurich, who was the actor who was the head of the Zurich branch of Surefire,
was it Christoph Waltz?
Yeah, Christoph Waltz. And he took these pictures and didn't realize that people could identify who they were. And then
at the press conference, did he do that at the press conference?
No, well, he is at the press conference. He did something like it where he supposedly had a picture of him with the woman who claimed to have written this affidavit claiming she was assaulted by Mueller. And it turns out people searched it. It's his girlfriend.
Is Jacob's girlfriend?
Yes. And it's also, is Jacob's girlfriend in her, like, 50s? Right? Because if this happened 30 years ago in 1974, presumably that woman would have had to have been, you know, over 20.
He's in O'Keefe territory now,
oh,
right?
Oh, totally.
He's going up that tree.
What is this clip of him? This is a clip of him at the press conference.
This is a few clips at the press conference, yeah.
Okay, this is him talking because people are giving him grief. Like, you say you're a longtime experienced investigator. You're 20.
Let's listen. Washington Post reported that Mr. Mueller, they re-reported that Mr. Mueller was at jury duty as to discredit this accuser. That's why they re-reported it. That's why it's going around.
Jacob,
but real quick, excuse me.
August 3rd, 2010.
Excuse me. Rather than double checking and saying, wait a second, was he only at jury duty? Sometimes people go to jury duty, but they're also somewhere else. Was he only at jury duty? No, hang on, it's not funny. This is not a laughing matter.
Pause it. There you go. He anticipated your laughter, Andy.
He's got Ricky Gervais's haircut from the 80s.
Here is when they start asking him about his age and how he could have so much experience as an investigator.
So you're 20 years old, Jacob, right? You're 20 years old. Describe to me your investigative experience And when did you get this honorary Harvard Law degree?
It's a figure of speech.
Pause it. Hold on. He apparently claimed he had an honorary Harvard Law degree. And, of course, that's a figure of speech, right?
Yeah. That's great. Oh, I hope this never ends.
Andy, I mean, like, how many times have you used that figure of speech that you have an honorary Harvard Law degree?
Is he wearing something from Star Trek, The Next Generation? Is that what the guy's wearing?
He should have had his sunglasses on.
He should have had his sunglasses on. He's like the Terminator. All right, let's go. Andy, just help me out here. How would you use honorary Harvard Law degree as a figure of speech in a sentence?
Figure of speech. You know, it's like I couldn't do it. It's an expression. It's an expression. That's what it is.
Stop being such a Harvard honorary law degree. That doesn't work. Are you hungry? God, I'm like, I've got like a Harvard honorary law degree. I'm so hungry.
All of a sudden, I'm starved. Starved like that time I ate my honorary Harvard law degree.
Are you tired? I'm so tired I could get a Harvard honorary law degree.
I also have an honorable fake mention from Yale.
There you go. All right, here we go.
And when did you get this honorary Harvard Law degree?
It's a figure of speech.
Okay. Okay, so you're 20 years old. What is your investigative? What is your background as a professional investigator?
Like I said, I've done a handful of matters. I've done a handful of matters like this over the years. My mission here is not to establish a narrative. It's not to follow an agenda. It's to bring forth the facts and let the facts speak for themselves, and that's what we've done here.
Jack Berkman steps in and he is giggling. Like, I don't understand what the hell this is about.
Who's using the excuse? The Trump patented excuse me. That's Trump's signature line.
They're all adopted. It's all gotten insane, Andy.
I like this. I love this Jacob Wall now. Look at him. He's so. Where do you go from this? Where does someone go from there?
Where does he go? This is amazing. So he put on. Where is this? Is this on Twitter that he put it up?
It looks like he blogged this out. So he like did like Microsoft Paint over her face and put it up on his blog.
Okay, so he says below is a photo of Wall and the accuser, who at this time is fearful of her life and requests to remain anonymous. This is upon arriving in Washington, D.C. She panicked and boarded a flight to another occasion. He posted this picture of him with the accuser, and then somebody again found that same picture, and it turns out to be his girlfriend.
And there's also a lot of interesting sleuthing going on. The ceiling was identified as an LAX and not in any DC airports.
This guy should never leave the house. He could green screen his whole career.
Now, when do you think, like, at what point, like, do you think, like, what do you think happens to this guy? Because I would bet. Within a couple of years, this is a guy who's going to be making a boatload of money doing some right-wing thing like Project Sort of Veritas or something like that.
Well, where's O'Keefe now? Is O'Keefe tearing it up?
Well,
is he killing it?
O'Keefe had apparently got a volunteer of Beto O'Rourke's on camera saying something to the effect of like, what was it? Was it Beto O'Rourke's or Gillum's? He got some volunteer.
He did a hike camp person too.
That's got people all over the place.
He's got volunteers for candidates saying stuff that's inappropriate. You know, like people who sign up to volunteer, like literally one of like the thousands of people. And then he refers to them as staffers, but they're usually like they're unpaid volunteers.
Oh, God, please let this be funny next Wednesday morning.
Yeah, no kidding. All right, should we play one clip of O'Reilly?
Sure.
We've got a clip of O'Reilly in his basement complaining about sensitivity training at Michigan State, or O'Reilly freaking out about Soros. Which one do you
want? Oh, I like him freaking out. I like him.
All right, this is the one about O'Reilly. This is O'Reilly's defense, right? After it turns out that Soros was the target of essentially an attempt to bomb him to death. Here is Bill O'Reilly. Remember, Bill O'Reilly was one of the pioneers in demonizing Soros, and he's going to...
I didn't know that even. I didn't even...
Oh, yeah, back in the day, back when he was like talking like, I went up to Harlem and ate... And you didn't hear anybody say mofo this or mofo past the grits, any of that. It was all normal. And this is...
What a great guy, right, Jason Silverstein? What a great guy. Financially supports democracy and human rights cause.
Pause it. He's reading off of a piece about Soros, and he's really upset.
He's steamed.
What a great guy.
Financially supports democracy and human rights causes. More than 100 countries. Ah, this is what I mean. You can't trust a word. Now, no mention that Soros was convicted of a felony in France.
Pause it. He was convicted of insider trading. Was that what it was? In France.
He's got the century book. Sam, don't mess with him. There He's got the century.
He
book.
Knows it all from last century, but that's last century. Okay.
No mention that Hungary, the country of Hungary, recently passed a law against him intruding in their internal politics. Didn't mention it.
Pause it for a second. Now there's
Hungary is a right-wing Nazi dictatorship, isn't it?
It is full-on fascist these days, and they don't like the Jews. You know, there's a long history. Gorka's little badge of Retzi or whatever that is.
Vitezi Ron
is all about Hungary's passing laws about the Jews.
The country of Hungary recently passed a law against him intruding in their internal politics. Didn't mention it. I guess Jason didn't know. This makes me furious.
Wait, CBS. Go back. So here's it's Bill O'Reilly's attempting to sort of to knock Soros. This is the way he tears apart this this piece. No.
Mention it. I guess Jason didn't know. Makes me furious. CBS News. All right, and then he writes a bit down.
This is a great show.
But the Soros scorn hit a fever pitch in the early 2000s once he became more involved in American politics, specifically opposing George W. Bush. He compared the Bush administration to the Nazi and communist regimes, saying Bush had improved on the techniques of governing by fear, and Soros spent more than $27 million unsuccessfully opposing Bush's 2004 re-election. Okay, so this guy Soros, he's a hero. He's supporting democracy. Silverstein goes on to write, quote, the conservative movement...
He doesn't have he just lays the predicate. He doesn't come back with the other half of the sentence. It's like, oh, he's supporting democracy. And then he runs out of, he doesn't have a criticism.
Hey, meanwhile, Soros, the Nazis in his own country hate him. That's what they think of Soros. They said to him, the Nazis in his own country said, don't interfere with our politics anymore.
He's a hero. He's supporting democracy. Silverstein goes on to write, quote, the conservative movement responded by unleashing fury on Soros, and he became a constant target for Fox News and other right-wing commentators. Bill O'Reilly ran a 10-minute segment on Soros, calling him an extremist and an off-the-chart dangerous person, accusing him of funding propaganda and manipulating liberal politics with his fortune. Absolutely true. I did more than 10 minutes, you pinhead. I did accumulation a couple of hours. It's absolutely true what I said. Okay?
Okay.
Propaganda.
Okay.
Manipulating liberal politics. Here's the proof. Jason Silverstein, get a little pen. Write this down.
There you go. Okay.
I think Javen...
Pinhead. He's bringing back Pinhead. I don't think he said that. I mean, I haven't watched him in a long time, but I think he stopped saying that on his Fox show. Maybe he said it more on his radio program back in the day.
Oh, because he found out it was an actual condition? Because it was an actual... It's based on... That's, someone once told me a lot of those words are actually based on old things, so they're really more insulting than he knows.
Wow, I had no idea.
No, but that's... But I mean, even the Lettermans used it, but I just found out all these things like imbecile, moron, they were all used... I don't know if you saw that documentary about eugenics.
No.
But, yeah, they all – those words were all used by this idiot who decided that people were feeble-minded and – I don't want to bring us down, though.
Oh. Andy, what's the latest? What are you up to these days?
Well, I'm coming – here's another chance for you to avoid seeing me Saturday after Thanksgiving – at Union Hall.
Oh, you're
I've got
kidding.
Two tickets with your name on them.
I may come back from Massachusetts early for that.
Well, I was hoping Michael would go, but apparently Michael can't even go to the when I'm on the make, phone.
He can't even make it to the show. Never mind go to your show.
Yeah, now he's gonna. Yeah, I'd like to see his story. Yeah, so that's all I really have going, and also Thought Spiral. Thought Spiral is charging up. Me and J. Elvis Weinstein is our, what is it called? A podcast.
Well, no, wait a second. You only have one show scheduled?
Oh, no, two shows on the Saturday after. Oh, no. You mean like other shows?
In the future?
Like a regular comic?
Hey, wait a second. Did you get a new website?
What's that?
You didn't get a new website, did you?
No, my website still has, for the people who like the classics, my 1997 tour dates.
I was going to say, like, I'm actually on your website right now looking at the calendar.
God.
And it only goes out like 3 weeks.
We can't. We're very busy over here. We can't constantly update my dates. I mean, what do you think this is?
Let's see. There's a big gap between...
Yeah, but that's because I'm working on my Union Hall shows now.
Oh, is that what's going on?
Yeah, I'm practicing. No, things will turn around for me, Sam. You know that. I'm on the Majority Report. Everything's going to happen for me.
You're on Thought Spiral.
Thought Spiral. And it's just me and Josh Elvis Weinstein, just two people. That's all we do. There's no guests, in case that helps.
What? And I
two
noticed
Jews.
Like on Twitter, I feel like you've been like calmer lately.
Oh, you know why? Because I've been on Prozac and I've been in therapy for 2 years.
Is that right? Is it finally kicking in?
No, the Prozac kicked in a long time ago. But I'm actually getting better, healthy, more healthy as a human being. Like used to be, I'd see something on CNN on Wolf. I'd watch somebody say something on Wolf. And I run to the computer. What's this idiot schmooky schmucky schmeaky from, you know, I was just crazed. And now I have an actual life, Sam.
I mean, I'm looking at, like, your Twitter feed, and it seems completely, completely tame. I mean, at one point, you just...
I like people. I like people.
You retweeted Eddie Gloud saying, thanks for the great conversation with four or five other people that you weren't a part of.
He was great. He's been on fire recently. I don't know if you watch him. He's on fire.
I
that
see him.
Guy.
He's really good. But I mean, he just all he did was thank other people.
You know, who also is great. That Brett is it Stevens. Oh, he's so inspiring.
Brett Stevens.
No, yeah, I hate him. Is he the guy I hate? The New York Times guy.
Oh yeah, you're thinking. Yeah, I know who you're talking about. Yeah, Brett Stevens.
People don't even know. He's not even on anybody's radar. He's the new. I love. I'm obsessed with the new conservative voices that are supposed to be moderate, like the guy at MSNBC, Charlie Sykes or something?
Yeah, well, Charlie Sykes, yeah, who, you know,
with all due respect to him, is as responsible, and supposedly he owned some of it, but he was very responsible for where the Republican Party is today.
Yeah. All of a sudden he comes out a couple of years ago, I don't like the tone. You set the tone.
Right. Let's see. Oh, and you did. You bought, I see back a couple of days ago, you bought a bucket of generic Prozac for $3 at CVS. That's great.
This is some of the hilarious tweets that I've replaced. Does that look like Dennis Miller has dentures?
Yeah,
can't tell.
It does.
That's dentures, right?
Yeah. I wasn't going to say anything about it. But...
I want him to have dentures so bad.
He does.
You know, yeah. I could eat all I want now with... and then do commercials for dentures.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it happens. Everybody's going to get there one point or another. I have a fake tooth.
What a hilarious Twitter feed I have, Sam. You're right.
Yeah, this is good stuff. Trump is like Hitler. If Trump is like if Hitler couldn't find Poland on a map.
I'm proud of that one.
There you go.
How come no one's laughing in studio? Oh, I forgot.
Nobody's here.
Stayed in studio today.
No, nobody's here today. Well, Andy... So you're gonna be at Union Hall. Is that it? Where is it?
Yeah, where are you gonna be? You're on the road.
Well, I go to Massachusetts for Thanksgiving.
Oh, that's right.
You know, hang out there, but maybe if I'm back in time, I'll go.
We should socialize those, Sam. I mean, or I should come in the studio or something. Or
I would love that.
Someone should fly me to New York.
Are you gonna be there for a while?
No, that's the only thing. Not on Thanksgiving, but I'll make a plan, or we'll all do a road trip. To Dennis Miller's new stand-up. I'm looking forward to the new chapter.
That would be great to see what happens after this. Well, Andy.
I love you, man.
I love you, too. Thanks so much for coming on. And it's always a good... Oh, well, I guess one thing that we had a problem with, Tom Sharpling. I mean, this is...
it's disgusting what he said, right?
It's disgusting. You said something very benign. In 8 hours, I'll be on the Majority Report.
Unbelievable.
Maybe I should try sleeping in between. And he Sharpling came back with, I know that in 8 hours, something will put me to sleep.
Oh, unbelievable. You know how far back we go? That's where it happens. Watch out for the people with the knives. Are those closest to you?
There you go.
Or something like that.
Andy Kindler, always a pleasure. Thanks, buddy.
Okay. Have a great weekend, man. Love you.
I love you too. Bye-bye. All right, folks, going to head into the fun half of the program, wherein we will take your phone calls and your IMs. We'll play a little bit more sound. Just a reminder, you can become a member of this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Just for pennies a day, you can support this program that has been member-supported now for, well... 7 years and 364 days. So thank you so much to our members. Really appreciate it. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. They've been with us since day one. Check out the Michael Brooks Show on YouTube, on Patreon. This week, you should listen to about Bolsonaro in particular. Because this guy is going to be a real problem, I think, for Latin America. And really, in many ways, is like, you know, gives an indication of just how contagious Trump is. I think there's a very strong argument that segments of Brazil would have rejected this guy if they thought there wasn't somebody even, you know, as ridiculous. The president of the United States really have lowered the standards here in this country. Also, check out the Antifada. You can find that at patreon.com, the Antifada. And for a real quality plug.
There's going to be a Patreon-only show this weekend.
What?
For Literary Hangover members. It's going to be a bit casual because the full show is going to come the following Saturday.
So. Mm.
But I'm going to read a poem by Bertolt Brecht, I think. Very depressing one, and talk about the book called Gotham. It's a history of New York. Have you heard of this book? It's a giant. It's like 70 hours long on Audible.
Wow.
Talk a little bit about that. But
Sounds good, though.
It's like The Power Broker, but for the colonial New York.
Interesting. And you're going to read the whole thing?
Yep, going to read the whole 70 hours. No, no, just going to talk about it casually a little bit. It's going to be a more relaxed thing for members. So
I see. All right.
Pontificate on some things.
Fair enough. I mean, speaking of casual, it's Casual Friday. You're wearing your shirt that is stained by your backpack. Pretty impressive. All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half. Oh, we do have a Reefer Cake song?
It's only 90 seconds long.
Let's hear it.
It's a diss track of Michael and Ronald Reagan, I think.
Oh, all right.
I'm gonna show you how to do it, son. I'm gonna show you how to...
With Rain Stop, a Ten Toed Man, and DJ Qing on. So good at writing songs, it just goes on and on. They wanna work with me because my lyrics are ill. Now Ronnie thinks he can push me off that hill. If you won't debate me, I call you a bitch. And the only thing worse than a bitch is a snitch. He summons Twitter haters who gather to fight. Got a bunch of these haters tweeting at me tonight. I'm trying to calm down and bake another cake. But when the reefer cake is cornered, he bites like a snake. Brooks refused to debate, proves he was a fake.
Bubble boys, don't make the same mistake.
Ronald Reagan wants me to be done. Hear that, everyone, he wants me to be done. I'm gonna show you how to do it, son. I'm gonna show you how to... Immigration, I think we agree. Open up the borders and set them all free. But I don't give a fuck if you're 6'3". I'm gonna call you out on hypocrisy.
Dumb left is a foolish meme. Agrees to debate, so he's cool with me. Bubble boys talk about reefer cake. Ron's in for real, but Brooks is a fake.
Talking shit about Reefer Cake, man. You best be ready to step in that ring, man. And when you mess with Reefer Cake, man, you better know. You better know.
DJ QAnon knows when it hits 90 seconds, the song ends.
Bubble boys, beware. I'm gonna show you how to do it, son. I'm gonna show you how to...
There you go. Wow, I think the gauntlet's been thrown down. I'm not 100% sure.
Something's been thrown down.
Something has been thrown down. All right, quick break. Fun half.